So Daniel chapter 3. It's a little bit of a long chapter, so buckle up. It's only 30 verses, but they're long verses. Okay, God's word reads like this. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. Cubits 18 inches, right? So you always do like 1.5 and you're there. So if it's 60 cubits, it's 90 feet tall, right? So just so you can not worry about the math as we read. Okay, so King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits, its breadth was 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, and there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. And maybe we pull in the first three verses of four, right? King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. That little bit is kind of a hinge. It can kind of go with chapter 3 or with chapter 4. So I just read it so we've got it all together. Whew. That's quite a text, isn't it? I mean, the repetition of the lists, right, the prefects and the governors and just Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over and over, right? But remember, in the Bible, repetition, always for emphasis. So if those things get repeated, you're supposed to go, why are they being repeated, right? So just kind of keep that in mind. Okay, so we start off with, well, you tell me, what's some just kind of shocking, interesting things that you just heard from that text? Anything at all? You tell me.
I have two things. One, this is like a classical literature comedy where you've got Nebuchadnezzar trying to advance his name, and all of the repetition of all these lists just punches up the humor and the futility in Nebuchadnezzar trying to make a great name for himself.
Yeah, that's very good. So let's park there for just one second. What is a comedy? In literary terms, right? You have like comedies and tragedies. What's a comedy? The good guy doesn't get killed at the end, right? I mean, that's pretty dumbed down, but you get what I'm trying to say, right? The hero wins. Like, that's a comedy, right? The guy gets the girl. The dragon gets slayed. You know, whatever. And you're exactly right. That's the kind of narrative we've got here. You had something else?
Yeah. The thing about him making an image of gold,
like,
hits like in verse 1, 2, a couple times, 3, a couple times,
right.
4.
Yeah.
Just that Nebuchadnezzar had set up over and over
again. Yep, that's right. That's right. And that word set up is a very key verb that we need to look at. That's very good. Anything else, you guys? Just anything at all? Yeah.
So. Well, in 15, he says, "Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?"
Yeah.
And then at 29, he says, "There is no other God who is
able." Yeah, right? It's incredible. Yeah. Very good. What else? Anything else you saw that was interesting, stood out to you? Millie?
In chapter 2, Daniel interprets a dream.
Yeah.
And Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold.
Yeah.
So he's magnifying that head of gold.
Very good. Nice immediate context work, Millie. Very good. Very good. Okay. A 90-foot tall statue? I mean, can we just park there for a minute? You guys ever seen these statues? When I preached through Daniel, I found this. I had no knowledge of this existence. But apparently in North Korea in the 1960s, they started, whoever was, you know, the emperor or whatever at that time or president, started to have huge statues of himself and other prominent leaders that went before him erected. And they're all over North Korea now. But you can pass that around if you want. The one that I'm handing you is 72 feet tall, so not quite as tall as the one described in chapter 3. But notice how small the people are at the feet of those statues. So just to give you some sort of sense of it. Where was the image built?
Dora.
Yeah, where?
Dora.
The what of Dora? Why is that important? Who cares? That's right. You ever seen something really tall in a plane where there's nothing else competing with its height. So we went to Pike's Peak, right, in Colorado. If my memory serves me, Pike's Peak is like the 14th highest mountain in Colorado. Like, it's kind of like, the 14th highest, really? That's the big destination? You want to know why everybody goes there? There's nothing competing with it. Everything's very low except for this mountain, and it looks like the tallest thing you've ever seen in your life because there's nothing competing with it. No doubt that was the effect that the king was going for, right? I also read one time, I spent some time in England, in law school. I spent a semester there studying international law and whatever, and a historian, or maybe I was on a tour or something, I don't remember where I acquired this info, but the Queen said that as soon as something was built in London proper, in whatever the region is that Buckingham Palace is in, I forget, maybe that's High Street, Kensington, I don't remember, but as soon as something got built a certain height, she was no longer staying at that place because she wanted Buckingham Palace to be the big thing in that area to show like the grandeur of the monarchy or whatever. But anyway, okay, so that's kind of the setting. And what else do we read about right at the beginning? So he set up this impressive golden 90-foot statue of himself. Right? What else do we know? Just right at the beginning, just for the setting.
And then he gathered everyone around.
Yeah, right? All these officials, like that it's obnoxious to read it out loud. I mean, no offense to God's word. Praise his name. It's holy word. But it's difficult to just repeat that long list like that over and over and over like that. But it's for emphasis, right? So the king has set up this huge monument of himself, and he's gathered. And who are those people? Yeah, they're officials. From where? It says it in the text. From where? From the provinces. From all of the different, you know, whatever, counties or states or whatever we'd say, right? And think about all of the different regions that the Babylonian emperor had authority over. This wasn't like 15 guys. This was like, I don't even know how many it would be, right? We'd have to roll up our sleeves and see if we could figure that out. But like, this is a worldwide empire. And so these are officials that are coming from everywhere, right? And what are they coming to do?
Worship.
Yeah, they're coming to worship really the king, right? The image represents him. Right? And he knows that. Why, Millie?
Because Daniel told him.
Because chapter 2, right? Chapter 2, remember, the Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and it was this statue, and every part of the statue was made of a different kind of material. The head was of gold, and Daniel said, God gave me this interpretation. That's you. What follows you will be a lesser kind of a kingdom. It's made of, I can't remember the different metals or whatever, maybe bronze was the next one. Silver and then bronze, maybe. Oh, that makes sense. And now he's saying, like, well, I'm going to make just this big one of gold, right? It's not unlike that North Korean statue, right? Okay. This word set up, you see it there? It's in verse 1. He set it up on the plain of Dura. It's in verse 3 that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. There's another one in verse 12. I don't know if I'll get them all, but do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. I mean, it's again in verse 18, like it's throughout the text. That's the verb that's used in the interpretation of the dream, right? Look at verse 44 of chapter 2. This is in Daniel interpreting. He says, and in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. So, lay 2 next to 3 now. Chapter 2 is describing from heaven, an interpretation that comes from heaven through God's prophet, through Daniel. And Daniel says, God sets up the kingdoms of men. And he'll set up your, he set up yours, he's going to set up another one after yours, and he's going to set up another one after that. And he's the one that determines who's going to be king at any given time. And how the extent of the kingdom and all and the duration of it and all that. Right? And now in chapter 3, we've got who setting up something? Nebuchadnezzar, right? What do you conclude from that contrast? That Nebuchadnezzar is trying to take the reins from God here. You see it both in the fact that the image is all of gold, right? So Nebuchadnezzar is trying to say, like, it's my kingdom that's never going to end. Because the whole body is going to be made up of gold, right? And also just the narrator cluing us in with that word set up. He set up this image. He set up this image. He set up this image, showing that Nebuchadnezzar is stepping into God's shoes, or trying to at this point. He's the one that's setting it up. He's made it all of gold. And what's more, he's gathered everybody from everywhere who's anybody and said, when the music plays, you're going to worship me. And I don't know with what frequency the music played, but that's the setting. That's how we open up this narrative. So we asked two weeks ago, what's the conflict in our narrative? What's the conflict here? We haven't reached it yet, but you already know what it is. What's the big problem of our text? Yeah, but who? Who are we talking about? You said who. That's a question. I want a statement. Tell me who you're meaning.
Which God are you going to worship?
Which God is who going to worship from our text? That's what I want to know. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Will these Israelites bow down and worship this idol, this king, because he's commanded it? Not he hasn't only just commanded it. What else? What's that?
Demanded.
Yes, but what else? Yeah, under pains of death, right? So yes, you're absolutely right. He's this hot-headed guy, and he's commanded it with all his authority, and you know it because he's got everybody who's in authority in front of him, and he's telling all those people, right? And the implication is that that the authority in all the provinces will filter down to all the people, right? And so, yet we've got these, you know, we're in the time of the exile, right? So we looked at that in chapter 1. So Israelites have been ripped out of the promised land, and they're in Babylon now. They're in this foreign culture, foreign language, foreign gods, foreign literature, all the stuff that Daniel and his friends had to study, right? And now they're being faced with this. Under pains of death, will they, in fact, bow the knee to Nebuchadnezzar? Well, everything seems to actually be okay because nobody really seems to know at first whether they will or won't. They're not even in the setup, the first section of the narrative. But how do they get introduced into the narrative? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. How do they enter in?
Somebody tells on them.
Yeah, who did? Yeah, the Chaldeans, is another way to say magicians, wise men. They were listed in that list of important people in court that would like give advice to the king and interpret dreams or, you know, things in the heavens or whatever. That's in verse 8, right? Therefore, at that time, certainly Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, they say how great he is, right, da-da-da. They repeat the command. And then verse 12, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. They don't serve your gods and they don't serve you. They don't worship your gods, they don't worship you. But notice, like, the words that are used here. Verse 8, they came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. That phrase is literally interpreted as tear the flesh off of, that adverb, maliciously. So you can kind of tell the, you know, what was going on inside those Chaldeans, right? And no doubt, we don't get a ton of description of those guys other than just that list being repeated. But they must have been filled with jealousy, right? Because they had been, all these people had been promoted, you remember. End of chapter 2, you see it in 49. Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. And they bring it up again in verse 12. These are the people you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, right? So there's likely some jealousy there, or at the very least, you know, maybe they didn't believe in this whole worship the statue thing, but they were doing it because they were under threat of death, and they're like, what about these guys? You know, and so you get that sort of spirit of competition, you know, that sort of thing. And so what happens? They get hauled in front of the king, and look at verse 13 there, in furious rage, right? So, and we've seen this rage from Nebuchadnezzar. He's marked as a hothead in this book, and we see it again. But here now, these three are facing off against the king and coming up against him. Now, he repeats in 14, you know, he's like, hey, we're going to run through this one more time. And if you're ready to bow down, then essentially I'll overlook, you know, your disobedience in the past, right? But if you don't, end of verse 15, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And then you have that scoffing question, right, that Sue pointed out. And I can't read this without, like, you know, reading it in like really mocking tones. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? You know, that's how I read it in my mind's eye, you know? So that's the conflict. So the conflict is, will God's people, right, in order to protect their, you know, their lives in this world, be unfaithful to God? Will they turn their backs on God and worship a false god in order to save their skin, right? And friends, I mean, this is a conflict that you and I need to hear about, because we're faced with it. We might not be faced with a fiery furnace, but many people in this world are. Might not be a furnace, might be something else. Might be having their head removed from their body with a sword. Might be being tied to a stake and burnt alive. So many martyrs down through church history have had that fate, right? And we are pressed today, and it's this, you know, it's this what this this well orchestrated, connected kind of program pushing against Christians in so many different ways. Think about, for example, homosexuality or transgenderism. I mean, if anyone stands up and tries to suggest that those two things are wrong, there's an immediate backlash. I just was reading, I can't think of what school, it wasn't a big school, but a basketball coach was fired because they spoke out against transgenderism. But I mean, as these things continue to push, this worldly agenda continues to be pushed, no doubt those kinds of consequences will become greater and greater, right? I just use that as an example. I mean, just forget like those hot button topics. What about just the idea of just like talking to somebody about Jesus, right? The world hates his name, hates the gospel, hates anybody that carries that message. Now, in God's mercy, the Spirit, you know, restrains people's evil, so that sometimes people are even like, you know, pleasantly, you know, like, oh, that's interesting. Like, tell me about the Bible, whatever. And, you know, that sort of thing does happen. Praise God. But we need to have a message about what happens when you're faced with saving your life or being faithful to God. And that's what this chapter is all about. So what is their response? Look at verse 16. They answered and said to the king, I love this, we have no need to answer you in this matter. What do you make of that? What do you think he means there? Let's just park here for a second. Look at that. We have no need to answer you in this matter. Why would they say that to the king? Let me ask it a different way. What might you say to the king in that situation? If you were faced with that, just think about, like, don't think about what's in the text. Think about just like, what are the possibilities of what you might say in response to the king if faced with that? You're about to be killed unless you worship me, right? At the sound of the horn or whatever, right? What might you respond right there in the moment to the king? Bob, what might you say to him?
Well, I might say something like this. You're giving me a terrible, terrible choice here. I mean, the God I acknowledge can kill me.
Yeah.
He can kill me in hell.
Yeah.
And you're telling me that I have to deny him.
Yeah. That's excellent. Excellent. Somebody want to add on? Thank you. That's very good. That's just really honest, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're just saying like, hey, you are putting me in an impossible situation.
Impossible.
Right? What else might you say to the king at that moment? Yeah.
Haven't we been like the best overseers you've ever
right?
had?
Right? I'm your boy. I'm in charge of Babylon or whatever, right? Yeah.
Throw away the welfare of the kingdom just because we won't.
Yeah. That would be, I mean, that would not be an unfaithful thing to do in that moment, right? I mean, let's be wise as serpents, right? Like, hey, Paul himself would say like, hey, let's get out of here or we're going to get killed in this city, you know, sneak down in a basket and different things and whatever. I mean, to be faithful doesn't mean to like, you know, impale yourself on a sword, right? It might mean that, but yeah. So there's different things they might have said, but what do you think they mean by we have no need to answer you in this matter? We have no need to answer you in this matter. What do you think, Vaughn?
Their lives have consistently honored their own God and only him.
Right.
So
yep.
Why should anything have changed?
Okay, very good. So in other words, like, hey, it's just another day in a long line of me following God. I don't know what you expect me to do. It might be something like that, right? My life speaks for how this is going to go down today, right? What else? Did you have something different?
The king has no authority.
Yeah, that's the other piece of it, right? Like, what, you know, like, you can set this up if you want, but, like, you are now entering into an arena, Nebuchadnezzar, that you have no power or authority in, right? I'm not going to answer a fool in his folly. It might be that kind of proverbial response, right? But they say more. Look at it. He says in 17, if this be so, in other words, if you're going to chuck us into the furnace, right? Our God whom we serve is first what? He's able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And look at this. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O King. Friends, that is some faith-filled words right there. Because I mean, the noose was slipped over their head at this point. And he's like, God absolutely, like, I don't need to answer you in this matter, right? You know, God is absolutely able to deliver me from this terrible fiery furnace that you have put together, right? And what's more, he absolutely is going to deliver me from your hands, O King, right? But if we stop there, there's a danger of kind of a health and wealth gospel situation here, where we say to ourselves, God will never allow a martyr a Christian martyr martyrdom to take place. God will never allow an evil person in this world to bring great harm to one of God's people. And we simply know that to be false. Right? And so faith requires that we, yes, believe that God can save us from the hand of the wicked one. But sometimes, in his providence, for his grand purposes, sometimes he doesn't. Not in this world. And so we read further, but if not, be it known to you, O king. In other words, if you throw us in that fiery furnace and it's as bad as people think it's going to be, and we're not spared from the suffering, and we in fact perish, and God doesn't come and take us out of there, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Friends, that these guys are the forefathers of the faith here to us. Hebrews tells us to consider the faith of those who went before us. We should do just that. Now, there's also a danger here in lifting these three guys up to superhero status, right? And saying, oh, I'm just not built that way. If only I had the courage of Shadrach. Right? If only I had the run into the flames for God, you know, for like Abednego or something like that. Friends, we have to look at the forefathers of the faith, foremothers and fathers, you know, the guys and gals that followed God before us. We have to look at their story and be inspired by their faith, not they themselves, right? Because all of us are kind of in the same place, right? I mean, we saw that in the last chapter of 2 Samuel last week, right? David is just like everybody else in the kingdom, right? Sin in everybody, right? So they have these grand, you know, this is like the best possible kind of response. You might be sitting there and saying to yourself, I could never do that. If faced with death, I think I'd cave. I think maybe I'd bow down. I think I'd try to do a half measure or something to try to get out of it or something like that. But let's just in the few minutes we just have a couple minutes left. Yeah. Okay. So the rest of the text, I've already read it out loud. What is the king astonished by immediately? He's astonished by this fourth figure in the furnace with them, and also that none of them are bound anymore. He had had mighty men tie him up and throw him in so that they couldn't, I guess, try to climb out. I don't know why. It's overkill because the guys that put him in the furnace died from the heat. Like, there's no way these guys were going to get out of this furnace on their own steam, right? He's astonished. He sees this, right? And verse 26, he calls them out, right, of the fire. 27, all the satraps and all these people that were supposed to be impressed by the king's grandeur, right? They all saw, look at it in 27, that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. Their heads weren't singed. Their clothes didn't smell like smoke. I mean, you ever sat by a campfire for 5 minutes? You reek of the smoke of it, right? And they didn't, there was no indication that they'd ever been in the furnace in the first place. There was no power over them. All right. So I'm forced to make some cuts here on the fly. Nebuchadnezzar calls these people out of the fiery furnace. That fiery furnace was a grave. It reminds me, I don't think that's what this text is pointing to. I just say it. It reminds me of Jesus calling Lazarus out of the tomb, right? But in a weird kind of switch-o-change-o here, the king calls them out. But he calls them out because he is astonished at God essentially saving them. God doing what these three guys said would happen. It takes place. But unlike the Lazarus encounter, where even Jesus calls the men out of the grave, God's angel went and got them, went down into the grave with them, so that they were unharmed. And friends, just consider this. That does indeed point to what Christ has done. He suffered at the hands of everybody that said, bow down to me instead of God, starting with Satan himself in the wilderness. And all of the Jewish leaders that ran right up to the point of his crucifixion. Gentile kings and Jewish leaders, high priests, and all these clowns that said, bow down and worship me, or, you know, the image, you know, whatever you want to call it, right? And Jesus took on all of the fury, the worst that the wicked one could do, wielded death over the Savior. And to what effect? We might read in 1 Corinthians 15, right? These guys are like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's like they already got their resurrection bodies so that they might say, oh, death, where is your sting, right? So friends, if you need to be encouraged to stand with God when faced with the threats of this world, look to the faith of these guys. It's like they believed that Jesus was coming for them, right? I don't want to import things to them that they wouldn't know, right? But the point here is that Jesus Christ endured the greatest suffering that this world can bring, and yet remained faithful perfectly, right? Even conquering them and demonstrating it. And he's now exalted on high, and he intercedes for you to the Father. His strength is your strength. His resurrection is your resurrection coming, right? All that you need to be faithful is laid before you. And we see it here in this text. That's all I got time for. God bless you guys. I'll see you in worship.